Hi, I'm Gordon Lanphier, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Pete DeSanto. Pete is an executive vice president of data centers at Enchanted Rock, where he is focused on meeting the increasing power demands of current and future data centers. On the podcast, we discuss all things data center and power. If you're interested in dipping your toe into the data center space, today's episode is well worth a listen.
Pete, thank you so very much for hopping on the podcast today.
No, it's a pleasure. I appreciate it, Gordon.
So, Pete, how do you go from like marine engineering to like microgrids and data centers? Because that seems like a huge leap.
It is and it isn't. So marine engineering, went to Massachusetts Maritime Academy. I was actually a Naval Academy reject. So I tried to get in the Naval Academy and they said, why don't you take a year to figure your life out? And the guy that was helping me at the Maritime Academy, a blue and gold officer, said, hey, go to Mass Maritime for a year and get above a 3.0 and then reapply to the Naval Academy because your nomination from the senator was still value, you know, still good for 2 years. So I go to Mass Maritime. Get above 3.0, sail across the North Atlantic, go to Italy, the Canary Islands, have an absolute blast. And then the blue and gold officer calls and says, hey, you got good grades. You want to get into the Naval Academy? And I said, do I have to start all over again as like a freshman pond scum plebe? He says, absolutely. That's part of the experience. I said, I'm going to stay right here at Mass Maritime. And so I had a great time at Mass Maritime. 4-year engineering program. And again, first job out of college was, you know, refueling reactors on Navy submarines for the government. But to really answer your question is like marine engineering is you're standing on watch, you're going out to sea, you're at a panel board, you're in an engine room, there's no spare parts. You have to, I mean, it's mission critical to get home type of thing. And you really have to be resilient in your thought process and solve problems, right? And figure out how to, you know, put some bits and pieces together if there's a problem, and you got to think on your feet and you have to go fast. And you don't have time to not make a decision. So all that to be said, I mean, it was really good training of how to solve problems, how to interact with people. And when I think about where I am now and what I've done in my career after that, because I didn't do that forever. It was a really good foundation, thought process and mindset of like, you don't get to take a day off. You have to like solve it now. It's not going to solve itself. And trying to figure out how to get to the finish line.
So one of the ways that we're trying to get to a finish line is we're trying to develop data centers and kind of finish off this world of high tech data. And the way that we get there is through power, right?
Right.
In terms of that, I think it's important for our audience who are very sophisticated investors generally, but they're not necessarily data center people. Can we start off talking a little bit about like what a data center is? Because I think there'll be some very sophisticated investors that when they hear data center, their eyes will start to glass over. So I'm just curious, can you give us kind of a brief description of kind of what the modern data center looks like?
So the modern data center, I'm from Boston, so I'm going to drop some R's and I apologize to the listeners. They'll probably figure that out.
Go right ahead.
But a data center in general, it's the backbone of our economy. It's the backbone of everything we do, right? We're on the internet right now. And we're doing this podcast and somewhere on a server, it's, you know, there's blinky lights and there's a rack somewhere. But the data center itself, it's a collection of servers and gear that one generates a lot of heat. Needs cooling and it's a power hog, right? It definitely needs some power to run and operate. And it also needs that power at high quality power. Can't have fluctuations in the voltage. And it also needs, you know, unbelievable reliability, right? Because in the middle of day-to-day life, I mean, if a data center were to lose power, like that means you can't swipe your credit card. That means your cell phone might not work. I mean, all those things are hinged. I mean, hinge through a data center of some sort. And it's the backbone of what we do. In the United States is probably 75% of the data centers in the world are in the United States for certain reasons. So, I mean, it's a big concrete shell filled with racks and cooling equipment. and backup power and, you know, UPS, uninterruptible power supplies. It's simple, but it's not an easy thing per se.
And in terms of that, you know, simplicity and putting things together, one of the big things that people talk about, and it seems so simple to people, but it's not necessarily actually that simple in reality, is how do you get all that power to the data center? Because I always hear, like, we work primarily with manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Often we have the conversation where, you know, hey, you know, we're going to need another transformer. And they're always, you know, blown away that, you know, we can't just put in more power. I don't understand. So I'm curious, how do you go about that process of getting more power? And does it come down to other factors as well, like site selection and kind of understanding, like, there are places that maybe power needs to be done, but there are also some places that you might not be able to easily get the power there, even.
Yeah. So I would start with this. I think there's two constructs here. You have one, I got a piece of land and I want to bring power to it and I want to build a data center. And then there's a little bit of a different process. If you have an existing data center that you want to expand on or increase, you know, upgrade the racks to more power hungry racks or a higher, you know, output rack where the servers are. So I would start with the piece of land and I want to develop it because it's the cleanest. So normally what you would do is you can't just go, you call the power company and say, hey, I need some power. I want to go build something, right? There's an interconnection process where you say, you have a design and you say, I want to do 100 megawatts. I need 100 megawatts of load that I want to put on the grid. Load being, I want to consume 100 megawatts. I want the wires and the poles to give me 100 megawatts of power. So I can go build this thing that consumes 100 megawatts. So you would go and work with, you know, basically the transmission supply company and the ISO, which is the independent system operator. And you'd say, like, hey, utility, I want 100 megawatts. And so you'd go into the interconnection queue. You'd apply for an interconnection, a load interconnection, and they would put you in the queue. What they do is a feasibility study of how much is already available on the line, at what voltage, transmission voltage, and they would do this analysis and, you know, and tell you how long it would take to give you firm service, meaning uninterruptible power, firm service for the 100 megawatts. Now, at a certain point in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, that was probably a much faster process because we had overbuilt the, you know, amount of power plants and wires we had in the United States. But right now, with everybody trying to hook up 500 megawatt, a gigawatt type of data center campuses, which is this massive amount of load that wants to come on and these applications being put in. In certain areas, it could be 6 to 7 years in the interconnection queue before you have the power brought into the land. That's an unbelievably long time. So if you're in the, I want to build a data center and put tenants in the data center and charge them, you know, get an economic return for building this, you need, everything's driven by the power aspect. So, I mean, if you don't have power, you don't really have much of anything. So, but that's how to, you know, hook up to the grid. And it's a lengthy process and there's some infrastructure. And a lot of times they're trying to solve for the full 100 megawatts versus, well, it's going to be 5 megawatts to start as I build out. And then it's going to go to 30 megawatts and then it's going to go to 75 megawatts. So there's some load growth as it gets built out, but that's simple. The utility is going to solve for the 100 megawatts, the peak load, the peak of what it's going to be used for. And that's what they're basing some of their time on. And the other thing is you could put in an interconnection request. I could put in an interconnection request and some of them are stacking. Your project might not ever go and my project does. So what's real and what's not. So everybody's putting in these applications and kind of clogging the system. So it's a convoluted process right now, and it's definitely getting streamlined. But that's kind of it in a nutshell, is that you would put in an application and say, I want to have X amount of power. And then they would come back and say, here's how long you have to wait in the queue to get that firm power.
So I know you mentioned the process of ramping up power, and that's definitely something that we've done for a couple of manufacturers. I'm curious, how have you seen that process play out in terms of the power ramping up process, and are there alternative methods to kind of band-aid power supply? I know there are some individuals that we've talked to in the past who have done kind of alternative fueling on site. Is that something that you've seen done regularly? Can you explain a little bit about
how the process works? So it happens all the time because when, just like I mentioned and you asked, you get a response from an interconnection request for 6 or 7 years. Now you put on the, how do I solution this problem? How do I get power? Because I don't want to wait 6 or 7 years. How do I get power in 12 to 14 months as I'm building the data center, data hall, and getting a customer on there? How do I marry the construction schedule with the power schedule? And I want to ramp up. This all speed to power. You hear everybody say, bring your own power, speed to power is a new thing. In the last, you know, call it 24 months, there's been this bring your own power. So there's a bunch of different ways and a bunch of different prime movers and things that can, you know, you have gas turbines, you have solar panels, you have batteries, you have certain things, you have fuel cells, wind turbines, you have different prime movers that can create electricity. Now a data center wants certain quality of power, and you, certain prime movers have operational characteristics that lend themselves better to a data center, but you can bring in temp power, right? So as you're building the load and the data center is getting built, as long as you have the right fuel source, and you can bring in gas turbines, packaged gas turbines, temporary gas turbines, you can bring in recips, reciprocating engines, you can bring in a couple of different prime movers. But what I've seen is, you know, they call it a bridge period. You're bridging between load being there and then the utility power coming in. So what is that power bridge that gets you from today to when the utility comes in and I have firm utility power? And so there's bridging options I've typically seen is you either turbines or recips, or turbines by themselves or recips by themselves. So some combination of natural gas. It all comes back down to natural gas is the most firmest thing, because I mean, you can put in solar, takes up a ton of geography. You need a lot of acreage for solar. But then you got to couple that with batteries because you need a lot of batteries because the sun only shines a certain time of the day. You can't shut the data center off at night, right? By the time the batteries discharge, you're in this discharge recharge cycle that it just doesn't necessarily work. Now you can add them with some gas turbines. And again, it's an algorithm of, let me add the right prime movers that I can get. And that's the next piece, is what's actually available to get, because everybody's asking for the same gas turbine, everybody's asking for the same recip, and it's, the supply chain gets messy. But when I have a land developer or developer call, that's the first thing I'm solving for, is one power. But I'm solving for natural gas. How far away is the natural gas pipe? If you're in Chicago, I got to call NICOR and find out where the gas is. Or if I'm in Texas, that's Energy Transfer or Enbridge or Kinder Morgan, and how close is the gas, and how much gas can I get in megawatts, so I can at least know, hey, I can get 50 megawatts of gas that's firm. I can build a 50 megawatt data center and put in a solution that's burning natural gas, and I can get the gas that I'm at least can know what my path looks like to powering that site. And that's a lot of what everybody's doing right now, is trying to figure out how much power, how fast, and do I need natural gas? What does that natural gas solution look like?
So how do you determine and how do you get that natural gas on site? Because I don't think it's as easy a process as some people make it out to be.
No, not at all. So, I mean, I've anecdotally talked to some folks and they go, hey, I have an option on a piece of land, and it's got a 42-inch gas pipe that runs through the land. And you're like, okay, give me the coordinates. We make a couple phone calls, and we find out whose pipe it is. We have a whole team of folks on our that just do natural gas. I mean, that's all they do, is natural gas solutioning. Good. And so they'll do some homework, and they'll call. It's Enbridge, it's Energy Transfer, whoever owns the line, the pipeline. And then you go back to the developer or the customer and you say, hey, we called that 42-inch pipe, it's fully subscribed. There's not a molecule of gas in there that's available for you. And then you get this like, what do you mean? It's a 42-inch pipe. There's no gas in that pipe for me. And you're like, no, it's all fully subscribed. It's all spoken for. Maybe you can try to duke it out with a LDC, local distribution kind of gas supply that's buying all the gas, and maybe they'll give you a couple of megawatts of gas, but then that gets really messy. So that's one option, is you either determine that there's space in the pipe for you and you get the gas from that way, or they got to bring in another lateral, which gets expensive. Like they might have to run miles of gas piping to bring you in a fee to your location. And that's, again, that's very expensive. So now all of a sudden you have to, they'll charge you for that. And they'll charge you an exorbitant amount of money, or they'll charge you what it cost them to go build out that infrastructure project. But now you're adding time, because they're not just going to go build a 36-inch lateral, 36-inch pipe, 3-foot diameter pipe, run it 5, 6, 7 miles to your location. That's one piece of it. But then they also have to have the gas that goes in the pipe. So upstream of them, is there enough supply or storage that gives you the additional gas? Otherwise, you suck down the pipe. So there's a lot that goes into the hydraulics and everything of like ordering the gas, supplying the gas. So that's one piece. Now, don't get me wrong, there are some other creative solutions. I mean, you can bring in temporary liquefied natural gas, right? There are companies out there that'll, if you have enough land, they will bring in and do temporary LNG, and you'll basically have LNG, liquefied natural gas, being brought into the site on a daily basis, putting into a vaporizer, which turns it from liquid into gas and vaporizes it so that you can run it in your gas turbine. And I mean, that's a risky proposal, and you'd have to have a lot of redundancy, but there's some ways to go. I'll just bring in, I still want to go fast. I still want to have power. So I'll bring in temporary gas, or I'll bring in temporary LNG and operate that way until utility gas comes in while I'm waiting for utility power to come in. So there's some options. Now, obviously, some of those options are exotic and probably a little bit more expensive. Cheapest pipeline gas and transmission electricity from a substation is the cheapest electricity and the cheapest gas. So you're waiting for those utilities to come in and bridge, so to speak. So, but normally we're solving for gas. Anytime somebody calls and says, hey, I think I have some land, I want to build a data center, we're looking at what does the gas infrastructure look like.
I mean, ultimately it comes down to things being, resilient and the redundancy and scalable. And right. Certainly bringing in natural gas on trucks isn't necessarily the most scalable and also the most resilient. So for those people who are doing that sort of method, I know you mentioned redundancy. Can you talk a little bit about why redundancy is important for data centers and kind of what some of those methods exist in the market?
So from a redundancy, they're always looking at the worst case scenario, right? Worst case scenario is a loss of power or a loss of cooling. And so everything is being calculated. They're doing all the math to say, in the current arrangement that we have with between backup generation or the substation or multiple substation feeds coming in or multiple gas pipes coming in from two different things, they are truly looking at a belt and suspenders type of solution that from a overbuilt redundancy point of view of how many nines of reliability. They're always striving for 5 nines. So 5 nines of reliability means 99.999% reliability. So, I mean, that's a lot of reliability versus, and to give a perspective, like utility power is typically 3 nines. So if you hook up to the utility, it's typically 99.9. So if you calculate that, 8760, like that's minutes of the year that the electricity is not potentially going to be available. So at 5 nines, that's a really short period of time of potential power interruption. Meanwhile, you have 24 to 48 hours of diesel fuel on site from your backup diesel generation. That's full scale backup. You have UPSs on site, uninterruptible power supplies. You have all these different things that are going to potentially supply power in the event of utility or weather that could knock out or interrupt your utility feed coming in. I mean, there's just belt and suspenders overbuilt of all this equipment going in just to make sure that there's no blip in the lights or the power doesn't go out.
And in terms of the blip in the lights, why is that so important for an investor?
Well, it interrupts. A lot of the stuff is sub-cycle, right? Meaning like fractions of a second. And that power quality or that power interruption, if you didn't have the right gear, it trips everything off and shuts it down. So all of a sudden you wouldn't maybe even potentially notice it. But if you're running, a large language model or computer, something like that, and you have a blip like that, even if it's a fraction of a second, that's basically lost time and you have to start over type of thing. And again, that interruption costs money type of thing. And it's And if you're the customer that has your data there, you're not going to be happy, right? So, I mean, from the whole stack and supply chain, like that's just not great to have, you know, to be supplying a data center or data hall to a tenant. That's just, that's bad business, right? So, I mean, and that's what you're selling on is the number of nines that you have, what infrastructure you have. I mean, if you're the Cadillac of data centers, I mean, that's what you're building your brand on. You don't want to have power interruptions, right? If you're a hyperscaler, you're one of, you know, if you're a Microsoft, you want to be a tenant in that data center that continues to have power interruptions? Probably not, right?
Probably not. So one of the other things that we probably don't want to have is data centers getting too hot. I know that's a huge conversation. And I'm curious, what are you seeing in terms of cooling in data centers these days? And is that cooling, you know, liquid cooled? Is it cooled through dry cooling? What are you seeing kind of used, and how does that affect power in general?
So I'm seeing a lot of innovation around trying to move towards dry cooling, water consumption. I mean, the liquid cooling and air cooling, like certain cooling methods consume some water, right? Evaporative cooling that uses a lot of water. And in that kind of environmental sustainability type of thing, there's a lot more being done with closed loop dry cooling. But regardless of what, you know, and that's to reduce water consumption. But as the chips and the racks, I mean, you know, you hear about AI and the large language models, and they're a rack back in the day, you know, 15 years ago, might've been 15 kW, 15 kilowatts of power and heat being generated. And now the racks are going to 200-300 kW, potentially up to 800-900 kW, or a megawatt rack or cabinet, as the gear gets bigger and more, you know, compact. It's still producing a lot of heat. So you have to do something with that heat. And again, typically in the past, it's been evaporative cooling or immersion cooling but you still have to have that heat rejection. You still have to run all those condensers and all that stuff. And that's where a lot of the power consumption is coming as well too. So it's still a challenge. I mean, cooling and power, and they're kind of intertwined. The more cooling you need, the more power you need as well, right? The non-IT load on the cooling side. So I don't know if I answered your question there, but they're really trying to move towards, how do I use dry cooling where I have less water consumption, a closed loop process where I'm not consuming water, and getting the best bang for my buck and best heat transfer so I can get that heat rejection out of the data hall.
So one of the things that when we're talking about data centers is we're talking about moving towards a more progressive, more efficient data center. And I'm curious, one of the things that's happened is looking at all sorts of alternatives. And I know you mentioned solar panels. How have you seen alternative fueling play out? And how have you seen, on top of it, nuclear power play out in the data center world?
So I think it's one that's been a lot of innovation. Now, sometimes it's done through PPAs, where one of the hyperscalers, I think it was Google, just signed a massive PPA on solar. And again, that just means that the incoming power they're purchasing is from a solar farm, right? So they wouldn't necessarily have the solar on site per se because of the operational characteristics. They'd still need to solve a different way for the sun went down, and I need a lot of batteries on site, but I've seen a lot of, you know, fuel cells are another one, but that's based on natural gas. I still see more opportunity for renewables to come on, but there's this concept of if they have a flexible capacity on site, they can actually use more of the renewables from the utility power. So it's one of those, all that, you know, it's moving in this direction, but having dispatchable resources on site, that they maybe used for the bridge period and then they kept on site so that they can flex that power back to the grid, is becoming more and more. But a lot of them are still investing in small modular reactors too, because that'll be one, it's very green and low carbon intensity. They all have this net carbon, you know, zero carbon kind of, you know, hopes and aspirations and targets that they're shooting for. So, I mean,
And can you dive into that? Can you explain a little bit about
Can
that?
about yeah. So I mean, they're looking at the carbon intensity, right? So when they're thinking about power and they're thinking about how they're building all their data centers and what they're using, they're looking at a CI score, a carbon intensity score, and they want to get to net zero. So that means they'll have to go carbon negative in certain things to kind of balance it out. And they're looking at how the electricity is being produced, what's the carbon intensity of it, how am I purchasing it, and with it being a a goal of going to zero and being having almost no carbon intensity. So again, there's a lot going into solar and thinking about that from a PPA, and just again accounting for where they get their power from and how, and what is the carbon intensity of it, and how do they get as close to zero as possible. And a lot of it is the cleanest and probably most reliable electricity is utility. So when you think about what can I do to keep, stay on utility power, because it's going to be the greenest and probably the cheapest electricity that I can procure. Because there's so many, I mean, I just think about Texas and other areas that I'm more familiar with, but there's a lot of wind and solar on the Texas grid. I mean, the Texas, in certain times of the year, will have upwards of 20,000 megawatts of wind on the grid, and tens of thousands of megawatts of solar, right? So, I mean, very green. They talk about it the same thing in California, but you still need some dispatchable resources that fill the gaps at night or when the solar ramps off. So, but again, still pretty green grid. But in certain times, there's constraints where what if the wind doesn't blow? And there's certain times of the year where in Texas, you might have 500 megawatts of wind on the grid. So you still need some dispatchable generation resources that can fill in those valleys. So all that to be said, there's a lot that's going into that mix of how they procure their power and what else do they have to firm up wind and solar and other renewables. So there's the va I can get so much during the day from wind and solar, but I still need something else that makes sure that I don't have a dip in power.
And when we're talking about modular nuclear reactors, which I think you mentioned, we're not talking about, big, huge Chernobyl-esque reactors that are
No.
from, the 1980s and 70s. And I think, as somebody who grew up close to several power plants in Illinois, I think people sometimes misunderstand what a modern nuclear reactor looks like. I'm curious. How have you seen that play out? And I think this will get into our last question, kind
Sure.
of where do you see the general misunderstanding is with the public with regard to modular nuclear reactors?
That's a great question, Gordon. So there's so small modular reactors there. I mean, when you mentioned Chernobyl, there was an RMBK Russian style in the Ukraine. There's a lot of pressurized water reactors and boiling water. The traditional commercial 70s, 80s, 90s Westinghouse, GE, General Electric reactors, and they were of the 600 megawatt to 1,000 megawatt reactors, big steam plant, big monolithic power plant, tons of concrete, the primary containment, small and acres and acres and acres of land and cooling towers that go with them. That big, that convex cooling tower that's typical for reactor in some instances. We're talking Connex size packages, right? Small modular reactors. A couple of technologies that are being demoed at I think Idaho National Labs now, and all of them are somewhat packaged in a Connex trailer where all the reactor, instead of a gigawatt of electricity from a large commercial traditional reactor, we're talking 50 megawatts thermal, that's 17 megawatts electric in a Connex trailer. So you're thinking of like Connex trailer sized potential reactors that you can put four or five of them in a row that go into one common steam plant, and you're creating electricity that way. And you can take a Connex trailer offsite, refuel it, bring it back. Meanwhile, if you had five of them in a row, you still have four running while you're refueling one. And the refueling doesn't happen on site. You could probably refuel offsite, drop in another nuclear battery, small modular reactor, and keep running. So they're very small, compact. I think there's still going to be that NIMBYism of not in my backyard. I don't know. Everybody's going to be excited to have a small modular reactor in their backyard. But I honestly think that's the way it's going to go. The challenge is, as always, we want that technology today. It's still 6, 7, 8 years on the horizon, maybe 10, to get that kind of fully articulated, commercialized, adopted. Who's going to refuel it? Who's going to bring it back? What does that, you know, that headcount look like, and the people that actually maintain it and operate it and control it? Still needs to probably be figured out, the fuel cycle and all that stuff. But I'm a firm believer that it's coming, and it's coming fast. And I still have some runway left in my career, but I mean, I started nuclear refueling Navy reactors on submarines. I wouldn't mind finishing my career doing small modular reactor microgrids and moving away from natural gas at some point. But yeah, I think it's definitely coming. I think it's going to change the landscape. And I'm glad we're accelerating in that direction. We just got Vogtle 3 and 4, the last two large scale commercial reactors in Southern Company's territory operational. That was a long time coming. So it'll be good to move away from those very expensive, very large power plants and going more towards the smaller, scalable modular reactors. It's going to change how we consume electricity.
So in terms of changing how we consume electricity, one of the biggest things that we've talked about generally are issues that there's kind of a gap in how the public perceives data centers and the power process. Huh. What are some of the biggest gaps that you see between how like ordinary investors and the general public see data centers and the folks that are actually in the arena working on data centers on a regular basis?
No, that's a good point. The perception thing stings sometimes. I dealt with this earlier in my career in the nuclear when I started in nuclear, is that not everybody understands nuclear and they think it had an unbelievable safety record. And I would say when you think about a data center going in and all that redundancy that we talked about and that interconnection queue that we mentioned, and during that interconnection, they're upgrading the poles, they're upgrading the substation, they're putting in more resilient equipment, they're putting in larger equipment. And if it was aging, they're putting in something brand new. So what I think doesn't get translated to the community that the data center is going into is that all of their gear is getting upgraded for the home, whether they know it or not. So there actually is some beneficial impact to the community. Besides the tax base and the revenue, and there's the same thing with nuclear. There's a lot of comparisons to nuclear of, I don't want that reactor in my backyard, but the amount of tax revenue and tax base that they brought in for schools and community and all that stuff kind of got overlooked. They just said, I don't want the reactor in my backyard. It's the same thing that I've seen with some of the perception around, I don't want that big data center in my backyard because it's gonna use all the electricity and there's gonna be none left for me. When you think about all those things we said about resiliency and availability, I mean, that means less brownouts, blackouts, power interruptions for the community that data center is in as well. And I can tell you that you see stuff in the news of like, think about Puerto Rico. I mean, the whole island lost power a couple of days ago. So when you think about availability of power and certain things like that, even today, we still have like the whole island of Puerto Rico losing power, right? Or the New Year's Eve, they losing power. And while that's terrible, like that, you can't have that in a data center, right? I mean, and the community that it's in gets the benefit of that as well, too. And don't get me wrong, I know there's a lot of outreach from the data center developers and those that are operating the data centers. But a lot of times it's listening to the community and what they need and also translating to them some of the features, benefits, and value of that data center being there.
So one of the ways we get value on this podcast is we do a little thing at the end called our final four. We love to do it. There's some tough questions and we won't let you out on any of them. Yeah, really tough. So in terms of that, one of our first questions and our favorite ones to ask is, where do you see data centers going 10 years out? I know a lot of that, you're probably going to get actually a pretty good idea because some of these data centers are 5 or 7 or 10 years in planning in some circumstances. So like, what are you seeing in terms of the future data centers?
So in terms of future data centers, I see it going this way, and I don't have a crystal ball, but I see them as a good grid steward, and a good grid citizen, where there's a potential in the future, and this is what I hope to see happen, is the normal grid base load for the rest of the consumer is wind, solar, and battery. And data centers, with being these large loads, they're flexible capacity that can turn their generation on and push it back to the grid. But the main base load is wind, solar, and battery, and very renewable energy for the bulk of the electrical system, which is not the case today. And then the flexibility of behind the meter resources at a data center. And again, some of these large campuses that are being built, I just see them being more restructuring how the grid is actually put together, and using nuclear and those things on site. I just see this future state of low carbon intensity, tons of renewables, net, you know, this green energy being produced and consumed, and data centers really being the backbone of the grid in the future, because they're not going away. There's a lot of them being built. So why don't we just harness what they do, and kind of, instead of just having all those assets on site and sitting idle, hoping for electricity to go away and turn on, let's exercise them. Let's use them. Let's manage that process and that load, and strengthen the grid and make them more valuable to the community.
So one of the ways that we get a lot of value as well is we like to talk to some of the men and women in the arena and learn a little bit more about them at the start of their career. I know, you know, probably, you know, a large, not the vast majority by any means, but a large portion of our listener base is probably under 35 at the very least, and is at like some early stage in their career. And so I'm curious, if you go back to the beginning of your career, what advice would you have given?
Jeez, maybe save one extra paycheck a month and put it into NVIDIA back then, or Amazon. No, I would.
Don't we all wish?
Yeah, right. No, I would. There's not much I would change, but I would tell my younger self to probably think a little bit more and put more effort into just electrical in general, the better understanding of just electricity. I was a marine engineer, like we mentioned earlier. I love steam plants. I love gas turbines. I love that type of mechanical / marine engineering and the adventure of going out to sea and those things. While I was a terrible student, I probably would have spent more time on electric machines, not electrical engineering. I think I picked the right major, but I'd kind of whack myself in the back of the head and say, buckle down more on the electricity side of my background, not kind of seeing that, you know, everything was going to be electrified at some point. Better understanding of that would probably just be useful in general for anybody in the current state of where we're going in the future. I mean, everything's electrified these days, or has telemetry on it, or sensors and AI. And I'd probably spend a tiny bit more foundationally on that.
Look, I think that's tremendous advice. I know for me, I would say a very similar thing with regard to code. I can code very basically. I can, you know, can do basic Java and Python, and it's been immeasurably helpful in my career. I look back at when I was starting to learn to code in high school, and I always think, oh, maybe I should have taken a couple more coding courses. So I
can code in Pascal. Maybe nobody's using Pascal anymore.
I you know what? I've heard of Pascal. That's about all I can tell you about Pascal. In terms of that, one of the other things that we like to do besides, you know, reading code or reading more about electrical is we look for kind of a book that might have influenced you, something to pick up and maybe read or listen to. Is there anything that you've had that's kind of shaped your mind and your career or your worldview?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of Jim Collins books out there, Good to Great and all that stuff. One that's been near and dear to me was a book called Traction by Gino Wickman. It talks about the entrepreneurial operating system. And it really, somebody gave it to me like 5, 6, 7 years ago. I was actually traveling in Italy with my family at the time on a family vacation. And I was on a high-speed train from I think it was from Naples to Rome, and I read the book in 2 hours on the train ride, and I just couldn't put it down. And it really spoke to me about not anything. I mean, it was the best probably business book that I've read. And again, it was talking about this entrepreneurial operating system, boiling things down into understandable bite-sized chunks, how you structure your meetings, how you extract value out of those meetings. And it was just, one, it was easy to read and the concepts were great. And it kind of reshaped my kind of management career and how I worked within a team and how I built teams. Do they get it? Do they want it? Do they have the capacity to do it? How you evaluate talent? It was just, it was a really good, it kind of spoke to me type of thing. So Traction by Gina Wickman.
Well, we'll have to pick it up, but there's one final question sure. that we're going to ask you, and there's no way that we're going to let you out of it. It's the whole point. Yes, exactly. It's scary, scary, scary. but you know, it's the whole reason for the podcast. We feel strongly that the men and women who are in the arena doing things and researching and getting their hands dirty tend to know the next best person to reach out to. And so I'm curious, who's the next person we should reach out to with regard to, you know, real estate, data centers, electricity, you know, anything that you can give us advice on?
I would say, man, that's a good question. I would say Bill Clayman. Bill Clayman, I've met him a couple times. He's on the data center circuit, data center world, data center dynamics, all that stuff. He would be really fun and entertaining and can go really deep on a whole lot of things data center specific.
Well, we got to reach out to Bill. And now as we're wrapping up, we have one final question sure. for you. And that's, this one should be relatively easy. It's just, if somebody wants to get in contact with you, Pete, what's the best way to do so?
Best way is LinkedIn. Reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on that. I post a lot of articles, drop some comments on a lot of stuff, but I'm usually pretty responsive on LinkedIn. So if you shoot me a message or link up with me on LinkedIn, that's probably the best way to get a hold of me.
Pete, thank you so much. We learned a lot about data centers today, and we have to have you on in the future.
Sounds good. Thanks, Gordon. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Pete. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoy the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.